This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. New York City is celebrating its centennial this year. Perhaps the man most responsible for the shape of the city and for its parks, expressways, and bridges is Robert Moses. Moses held 14 state, regional, and city offices, ranging from city parks commissioner to construction coordinator. My guest Robert Caro won a 1975 Pulitzer Prize for his book about Moses called The Power Broker, Robert Moses and the Fall of New York. It's now seen as a classic study in the use and abuse of power. Caro went on to study the use of power on a national level by writing a series of books about Lyndon Johnson. The two published volumes have each won National Book Critics Circle awards. In the January 5th edition of The New Yorker, Caro wrote about Moses' impact on New York City. I asked Caro first about the significance of the city's centennial.
Well, exactly 100 years ago, in January 1898, the five boroughs of New York City were united, consolidated into a single city. Before that, what we think of as New York was really Manhattan and the Bronx. With the consolidation of New York, Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island were added to the city, and it became, in that one moment, the largest city in America, with a population of over 3 million people, and also the most extensive, about 320 square miles. And that all happened in this one moment 100 years ago.
You describe Robert Moses as the man who more than any other individual shaped modern New York. What was his role in the building of New York City?
Well, you know, he was in power for almost half this century that we're talking about today, for 44 years, from 1924 to 1968. During that time, seven great bridges were built in New York. You know, the city, we think of New York as a city, but it's really four islands. Only one of the five boroughs, the Bronx, is on the mainland of the United States. So the city had to be brought together. The city had to be linked with bridges. Robert Moses built every one of the seven great bridges that linked the boroughs together since 1917. He built the Verrazano Bridge, the Triborough Bridge, the Bronx Whitestone, the Throgs Neck, the Henry Hudson, the Cross Bay, and the Marine Parkway. He built every one of the expressways that run across the city, these great roads, the Long Island Expressway, the Brooklyn-Queens Expressway, the Cross Bronx Expressway, the Major Deegan, the Van Wyck. He built every one of them. He built every one of the 11 parkways that run through the city out towards the suburban counties of Long Island. And he built every one of the parkways on Long Island. During this half a century that Robert Moses was in power, he built 627 miles of expressways and parkways, many more miles than any other individual in history.
I think one of the things that makes your book, The Power Broker, about Robert Moses so interesting is that you not only talk about his grand vision, but you talk about the price that the city paid for that vision. You talk about not only what he built, but what he needed to destroy in order to rebuild New York. What's an example of the destruction that he caused?
You know, when I was doing the book, Terry, I decided to try to look at and portray the human cost of these great highways that he was building. And he built 627 miles of expressways and parkways. I decided to concentrate on 1 mile. So I took a mile of the Cross Bronx Expressway as it ran through the East Tremont section of the Bronx, which was a poor but lively, stable community, largely Jewish but with substantial German and Irish and black, well-integrated populations in there. And I found he built these roads with an absolute disregard for what was in their way. And in this particular mile, he took a route which destroyed 54 separate apartment houses, throwing really thousands and thousands of people out of their homes and destroying the community, when there was available just 2 blocks away a parallel route which would have destroyed only 6 small brownstones.
Why didn't he take the parallel route?
Well, political considerations were a very important factor in the way Moses exercised power. I say in the book, we don't really know whether it was simply because of his whim that he said it was going to be that way and that's the way it was going to be, or whether the only things that would have been condemned on the other route were six small tenements and the Bronx depot of a transit company in which high-ranking Bronx politicians had hidden interests, which was very profitable to them and which they didn't want condemned.
Well, you investigated the techniques he used for relocating the thousands of people in the East Tremont neighborhood that needed to be relocated to make way for this expressway. So how did he let them know they had to move, and how did he make sure they got out in a timely fashion?
One day, everyone along this route, thousands of families, got a letter from Robert Moses saying the Cross Bronx Expressway is going through and you have 90 days to move. And the men and women who lived there, whom I interviewed at the time, thought I had to go, you know, find them wherever they had moved to, described how they gathered out on the street, holding the letters saying, 90 days to move. What is this? It was like the earth opened up under our feet. So they tried to fight, but they found that although their elected officials agreed with them, it didn't really matter what those officials wanted. The only thing that mattered was what Robert Moses wanted.
And how did he help push them out so that they'd get out quickly?
Well, of course, they didn't have to get out that quickly. One of his assistants said to me the 90 days was just to shake them up a little bit, to get them moving. The actual construction of the expressway in that area was not to begin for 3 years. But as soon as some people moved out of their apartments, he'd immediately board up the windows as an advertisement that the apartments were vacant and available for looting. When people moved out of the top floor of these apartment houses, he would immediately tear off the top floor of that apartment house as soon as it was vacant. As one woman said to me, while we were still living there, he was tearing the buildings down around our heads. When he got one or two tenements along this route vacant, he immediately demolished them and left the foundations as gaping pits in the ground and refused to build fences around them, so the remaining residents were afraid that their children would fall in. He used the most ruthless means possible to drive these people out, and he was successful. In a very short time, those 54 apartment houses were vacant.
Well, do you think in the long run, you know, a lot of people had their lives shaken up, some people had their lives ruined, but could you say in the long run it was worth it because for decades after, New York has had better highways, better roads? You know, that in order for a city to grow, some people have to pay a price.
It's a very complicated question. Because you really say, if the city had not been made so dependent on the auto, would the whole shape of the city have changed? When he was building the Long Island Expressway, in the 1950s, out through Nassau and Suffolk counties, New York suburbs, those counties, Suffolk County, was still largely potato fields. The cost of land was so cheap that buying land for it was very inexpensive. And every urban planner who dealt with Moses said to him, build a rapid transit line down the center of the Long Island Expressway. It's very cheap to buy the land for it. I forget the exact figure, but it was an infinitesimal amount compared to the cost of the expressway. You needed 80 feet for the center mall. Moses refused to do that. And then they said, well, if you don't want to build the rapid transit line, at least buy the 80 feet. Then in future generations, if people want a rapid transit line, they'll be able to put one down the center of the expressway. He refused to do that. And as a result of that, in fact, he even did certain engineering things which will make it impossible for the Long Island Expressway ever to have rapid transit down it. So the whole shape of Long Island might have been different And if we take that, you know, for many of these expressways, you say, well, things didn't have to be this way. At the same time, what you say is really correct. In some way, these roads are a benefit. So in The Power Broker, I really say that it's impossible to say whether New York City would have been a better or a worse city if Robert Moses had never lived. But it is necessary to say that had Robert Moses never lived, New York would be a very different city than it was today, than it is today.
My guest is Robert Caro, author of The Power Broker, Robert Moses and the Fall of New York. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Robert Caro, author of a book first published in the mid-70s called The Power Broker, Robert Moses and the Fall of New York. It won a Pulitzer Prize in the mid-70s, and this year is the centennial of New York City. A good time to take another look at how New York City was shaped by Robert Moses and his use of power. One of the things that you uncovered while investigating Robert Moses and his use of power was that Robert Moses forged a secret deal with a multimillionaire who owned a large estate in an area that Moses wanted to go through to build a parkway, the Northern State Parkway. And when he realized that he would offend this wealthy, powerful multimillionaire, he moved the parkway someplace else where it went through the land of several small farm owners, just really ruining the lives of most of these farm families. What was it like for you when you found this secret agreement?
I was looking through the papers of the old governors, Al Smith and Franklin Roosevelt, from the 1920s and 30s, and I found that Moses had, in fact, accepted. Now, he didn't, there was no personal dishonesty in this. Moses was not interested in money for himself. Someone once said to me, some men are interested in caviar. Robert Moses was happy with a ham sandwich if he could have power on the side. But the legislature was blocking the construction of the Northern State Parkway and wouldn't even give money for surveys. Otto Kahn, who was a multimillionaire, had in the Dix Hills this immense estate, including his own private 18-hole golf course. And he said that he would donate $10,000 to the Moses' Park Commission for surveys, provided that part of the surveys found a new route for the parkway that did not go across his golf course. Moses moved the parkway, did that. The surveys found a new route to the south. But to the south, there were the estates of other immensely wealthy and powerful robber barons. So he moved it south again until he came to this line of 21 small farms. And that's where the parkway ran. And one day a representative of Moses suddenly showed up and told these farmers that land was out of, in, from the middle of their farms was being condemned for the parkway. When they said, can't you just move it a little further south? They said, no, engineering considerations dictated that the route would go here. Well, I and my wife eventually found some of these farmers. And the human tragedy that was involved from this change in the parkway route was so striking. It ruined their lives because the condemnation awards never came to much. The farms were divided in half. And one of these farmers, James Roth, you know, he begged Moses to move the parkway just 400 feet south, less than one-tenth of a mile south. Moses refused. And I wrote in the book something like, I said, for men of wealth and power, Moses had already moved the parkway 3 miles. For James Roth, who had neither wealth nor power, he wouldn't move the parkway 1 foot.
On the one hand, you could argue that Moses was a pragmatist. You don't get things done in New York unless you play by certain political rules and cater to the people who have the power to give you what you need. You can be an idealist and hold on to your morals and get absolutely nothing done. Moses knew how to play the power game and got a lot done. On the other hand, he portrayed himself, from what you say, in a really dishonest way. He portrayed himself as an uncompromising public servant who was above politics, which clearly he wasn't. And he kept all these deals a secret, so he was able to have a dishonest view of himself. He was able to represent himself in a way that he really wasn't.
Yes, and you have to, you see, that's why the story of Moses and of political power in general is such a complicated one. Mm-hmm. There's no easy answer to this, because you really say, what was the city like when he came to power, and what was the city like when he left power? When he came to power in New York in 1924, New York was a city really bright with promise. At the time he left, New York was a city, left power, New York was a city really, if we can look back that far and imagine that time now that the city is on the rise, of a place of chaos and despair. He built housing, but the kind of housing he built for poor people, he tried to keep it. He tried to make people feel that they were poor. He believed in that. He believed in the ghettoization of the city. Believed that classes, you shouldn't build low-income structures in upper-income areas. He concentrated always on diverting the city's resources to the middle and the upper middle and the upper classes and away from the lower classes and the lower middle classes. This had great impact on the course of the city's development. You really can't say, as I said before, that New York would have been better or worse if he had never lived. What you can say is this one man shaped the city as we know it today. No mayor shaped the city. No governor shaped the city. Robert Moses shaped the city. The city we live in today, 30 years after he left power, is the city that Robert Moses shaped, not just with his highways, his parkways, his bridges, and his parks, but because for over 40 years, despite the wishes of its elected officials in many instances, he skewed the city's policies, the city's resources, the use of the city's resources, away from trying to integrate and bring the new immigrants and make them really part of New York into projects which would benefit the middle and upper middle classes.
Because of secret deals that you revealed about Robert Moses, and because you showed how he abused his power as well as how he used it for the good, he was very angry with you. He hated your book. He denounced your book.
Yes.
You didn't even go to his funeral, even though you wanted to, because you sensed that his family would not have wanted you around. Did you feel bad about that? I mean, everybody wants to be liked.
Well,
you devoted so much time to this man, and you know, he hated you for it.
Well, when, you know, he loved to build. He had great dreams. The Power Broker, you know, is not in any way a wholly negative book. I would say the first 300 or so pages are about this young idealist with these great and beautiful dreams. And I admired those. And I saw how important it was for him to be able to build. During the time I was writing The Power Broker, when I started it, he was at the very height of his power. But during the time I was writing it, he was removed from power. He was then about 80 years old. And when I realized that he would never be able to build anything again, my emotions, you know, he had a lot of emotions toward him. You always do about someone you write. But now I started to pity him as well. And as years passed and he kept fighting to get back into power and to get to build something else, and he couldn't do it, I really became very sad for him. At the same time, you also have to feel pity for the people, hundreds of thousands of people, that he displaced from their homes, often without any good reason, so that he could realize his dreams. It's really too complicated to try to put Moses, or perhaps any great political figure, to try and sum him up. And that's what really what I learned when I was doing this book. It's very complicated. When he died, of course, as you say, I wanted to go to his funeral. I felt it would ruin it for his family and his friends if I was there, because he hated the book so much. So I didn't go. I must say, as I walk or drive around New York, there's scarcely a day that I don't see something on which he left his mark and which makes me remember him. And to tell you the truth, the way I feel now, 23 years after the book came out, is that there's a great void in my life because he's not filling it up anymore.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Robert Caro's book about Robert Moses is called The Power Broker. Caro is at work on the third of a projected 4-volume series of books about Lyndon Johnson.